I'm really, really excited. Actually, we have such a full house, so thank you all for coming. My name is Melanie Savenko, and I'm a programming coordinator at Hot Docs. I'd like to welcome you to our third and final Hot Docs talk, The Art of the Interview. And before I get started, I just want to give a special thanks to our sponsor, which is the Canadian Television Fund. And please be aware that the Creative Communications Department at Centennial College is kind enough to tape this talk for podcast. So if you'd like to listen to the talk again, or if you want to share it with your friends and family, please visit the Centennial College website, and you can navigate your way to the Hot Docs talk online. So without further ado, please join me in giving a very warm welcome to our moderator of this afternoon's panel, filmmaker Elf Landers.
Thank you. Thank you. It's great to see such a wonderful turnout, and I think such a good Toronto turnout for very esteemed filmmakers and who have got me sitting on edge here today. See, notice I'm already shuffling and dropping papers. So I'm just going to give you a sense of how we're going to do this today. What I'm going to do is I'm going to introduce you to each one of the panelists with very brief biographies, and forgive me if I've forgotten anything, and they will slip in whatever they feel is more important. They will then show you a clip of the films that they have here at the festival, and they will describe to you their film, and then we will commence with the interview. After that, we'll open it up to you guys for questions, and we will talk about the interview in the interview. So just sort of as a by way of introduction, just to sort of, it struck me that almost I want to talk to you a little bit about John Grierson, and then I realized that, of course, every discussion about documentary in Canada begins with John Grierson and the NFB. And John Grierson's idea was that documentary film would help build a stronger nation state, and that increased knowledge of Canadian industry and labor, history and social problems would help that cause. And I think what we're seeing today, in contrast with what I guess I'll call the new documentary, I think the new documentary works to actually promote a critical challenge to entrench power. So Grierson had a famous definition of documentary, and he said that documentary was the creative treatment of actuality. But of course, this begs the question of the meaning of creative and actuality. On the other side of the spectrum, of course, at this time, lay the radical opponents of realism-based definitions, such as Jean-Luc Godard, who claimed and insisted that everything is fiction. So it would seem to me that new documentary works tend to carve out a middle ground between these two positions. So on our panel today, we have a good cross-section of filmmakers, several of whom set to blur out the old critical categories. Each one, however, nonetheless employs narrative structure, just like fiction films. After all, we are still telling stories of one sort or another. And as Hedy said last night, we're making stories to perhaps create some sense of order out of chaos. The key element in this art, of course, in the art of documentary filmmaking, is the interview. So how each one approaches this structure differs widely between all our panelists here and, of course, in documentary film in general. And today we're going to explore some of those approaches and techniques. So with that, I'm going to introduce you to our panelists. And I'll start on my far corner over here with Judith Helfand. Judith Helfand is a filmmaker, activist, and an educator. I actually came across Judith Helfand first. I think the first film of Judith's I saw was Blue Vinyl here at Hot Docs, but I also knew of Healthy Baby Girl before that, which we had seen that I saw as a student. And then I met Judith when she came to Hot Docs with Blue Vinyl and opened the festival. It was a number of years ago now. She's back here again with what she calls a toxic comedy, and her new, is that correct? Okay.
Sometimes we're nervous about calling it a toxic comedy because then everyone will feel like, oh, it's going to be really funny, and then they're disappointed, so.
Oh, sorry. So I'm so sorry. The art of the interview is first make sure they're talking in the microphone. After that, it's all up to you. Okay, yes.
But it's called Everything's Cool, yeah, which premiered last night, right, and has premiered at Sundance and several other festivals.
Right.
Judith, as an activist and as an educator, also started Working Films. Working Films is this incredible organization that started to think about how to actually distribute documentaries by way of also educating and sort of creating educational materials that go along with documentary film. So it's not your average distribution
network.
We're
actually not a distributor.
No.
I have to say.
But distribute in the broad sense of the term of getting the films out to the public.
From an activist perspective.
From an activist and an educational point of view. Judith will show us a clip of Healthy Baby Girl of Everything's Cool.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking about what you did first. So John Zaritsky is next to Judith. John has made 35 to 40 films. He can't count anymore. he has also won more than 30 awards for his films. Some of his major honors include the Academy Award for his 1982 documentary, Just Another Missing Kid. He's also won the Robert F. Kennedy Foundation Award for Born in Africa, and the Alfred Dupont Award from Columbia's University School of Journalism for Romeo and Juliet in Sarajevo. John's films have appeared on everything from PBS to Frontline to CBC and on and on. His film here that we have at the festival is called Suicide Tourist, which has already screened, and I don't know if you have another screening.
Yeah, on Sunday at 4.
You have a screening Sunday at 4. And Judith?
Tomorrow at 4:30.
Thank you.
Oh, cool. He's sold out. Come to mine. Okay.
And
always so on the ground tickets, Judith. On the ground tickets.
Yeah, we're going to start scalping. So, well, Hot Docs has become that popular, actually. So, and over here we have Hedy Honigman. Hedy Honigman has won the Achievement Award here at Hot Docs and is winning the Lifetime Achievement Award coming up in San Francisco. Is that correct?
Correct.
And from what I understand, that in no way does this Lifetime Achievement Award that you have any intention of stopping to make films.
Not at all.
Okay. Hedy was born in Lima. She trained as a filmmaker in Rome, and you have lived and worked in the Netherlands since 1978. Hedy isn't particularly interested, according to this article that I have here, which I thought was quite wonderful. And it's this honor. It's from the honoring at Hot Docs. She isn't interested in railing against social inequities, despite the sense of political dissatisfaction one hears rumbling under her movies like a dyspeptic subway train. Rather, she is obsessed with the way people of often limited means deal with those inequities through art, through love, through sex, and through memory. And I have to say, I've spent many hours now watching many of Hedy's films, and you're in for a treat with, of course, everybody's film here, but it is a great honor to have you here at Hot Docs, and of course, for this Lifetime Achievement Award. And last but not least, I have not lost your bio, but I think I remember it. We have Jennifer Fox, and Jennifer is here at Hot Docs with Flying, Confessions of a Free Woman. And I spent 4 hours watching this six-hour episode at the ROM and spent the next 2 hours in a much more comfortable situation of my bed watching the rest. It got a little hot and heavy for me. So it's a wonderful six-hour serial, and Jennifer has been making films for 25 years and producing, directing, and also doing cinematography. She's also been an international teacher of documentary directing. Her first film was called Beirut, The Last Home Movie, and it was shot during the war in Lebanon in 81 and 82. And she's won numerous awards, including Sundance Best Doc and Best Cinematography. Just to be clear, everybody here has won numerous awards for their films. she's also executive produced many films, including Love and Diane, and a 10-part series called Project 10 in South Africa. Project 10 in South Africa kind of appears a little bit in her film here in Flying, and you sort of get a sense of the project that she was doing with people to celebrate the 10th anniversary of apartheid in South Africa. So please welcome all our esteemed panelists. That was a long intro, but I'm sorry, they're very accomplished. So please welcome them. So Judith, we're going to start with a clip from you. If you want to set it up for us, that would be great.
I co-directed and co-produced Everything's Cool with Daniel Gold, who was actually supposed to be here and was going to be sitting right here, but had to stay home, take care of some family responsibilities. So I'm sitting in for him. So I hope I chose the clip that Dan would have chosen. But if I didn't, it's one of my sort of favorite and sort of pivotal moments in Everything's Cool, which we follow a group of self-appointed global warming messengers who are struggling to sort of get the word out, find the right message, find the iconic image, do whatever they can to sort of get this. Their understanding of the urgency of global warming to the American people, and help themselves find the political will to sort of deal with what's going on from an American perspective. And so we just follow these folks in the United States. So we really were trying to sort of take sort of this problem of messaging global warming and go and look at it through the eyes of the messengers who were struggling with that problem in and of themselves. And so we'll look at a clip with Ross Gelbspan, who we, between ourselves, we call him the Columbo of climate change, because there's always something else that he could tell us. during the course of the film, he's sort of at this. He's been working so hard for so many years, and you know, it might seem like everyone in America is all of a sudden listening, but it hasn't quite been like that. And so he's always on the brink of quitting and retiring. And I don't really want to ruin it for you. I probably shouldn't be showing you the ending. Why are you going to come? But anyway, this is sort of it's crazy, a little counterintuitive. But this is towards the end. And it was a unique interview situation. And so that's why I chose it. And it's a little bit of my style, which is a little interventionist. I'm there.
Future. Most surprising in our poll, while half of Americans say they're now experiencing warming, 64% still mistakenly think that there's a lot of disagreement among scientists about whether global warming is happening.
American people have just been bludgeoned with climate disaster stories for God knows how long, and they're just, they've got disaster fatigue.
Pat Michaels is one of a handful.
Okay, are you quitting or are you not quitting?
Am I quitting?
He's not quitting, quite.
I'm not quitting, but I think the next book to write is, and what I've really been avoiding writing completely, is what is the existential response to in an age of collapse? I mean, we're talking about a real change in the evolution of our species and our civilization. We're talking about a really big deal change. How is an intelligent, honest person supposed to relate to that?
How does that feel? Talk about the end of the world with your daughter sitting like half a foot away.
Not good. Something I'd much rather not discuss with my daughters.
I think in the past it was easier for you to feel optimistic.
Yes.
About certain
That's right.
possibilities
That's
of things
true.
Getting fixed. And
yep.
now you've been a lot more sobered by political realities in the face of the information you've seen.
Natural and reality.
I mean, we still need to try to stop it here because it's a matter of degrees of how bad. You know, civilization will be profoundly destabilized, affected, but that still doesn't give a reason to give up, in my view.
G, John, would you be good enough to set up your clip for us?
Sure. The Suicide Tourist is about, we follow the chronicle, the last 4 days in the life of a 59-year-old American living in England who is suffering from ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease, and he's decided that he will travel to Zurich, Switzerland, to a clinic called Dignitas, where he can receive assisted suicide. And so the clip I've selected today is Craig Ewart, the 59-year-old American, making just part of the case that he makes at different points through the film as to why he's decided he should die and why he feels that's the right decision for him.
Point. You know, I've got two choices. I either actually go through with it, or I say, you know what, I'm too scared right now. I don't want to do it. If I go through with it, I die, as I must at some point. If I don't go through with it, my choice is essentially to suffer and to inflict suffering on my family. And then die. Possibly in a way that is considerably more stressful and painful than this way. I've got death. I've got suffering and death. Well, gee, you know, this makes a whole lot of sense to me.
What do you think about this power toothbrush? Do you think it helps?
Now we're going to move to Hedy, and I think you're going to show us a clip first from Underground Orchestra.
Yes. Underground Orchestra is a film about exile, but through musicians who, in the countries where they, the countries that they left, they were very much appreciated than in Paris, where they live now. So I'm showing a clip with a Romanian cellist who was a cellist in the symphonical orchestra of Timișoara. That's the place where the revolution against Ceaușescu began. And he was obliged to, that's what he tells in an interview before this scene, obliged to remain in Paris. His wife called, the orchestra was touring in Paris, and the wife called and said, you have to stay there, you have to do it for our sons, and because the future is much better in Paris. And he has a son, and I've met the son and the father once in a cafe. The son just came around, and I was talking to him, and he was comparing classical music. He's in the conservatorium, and in fact, he plays much better than the father. And his future will be much rooskleurig.
Would say that more promising.
Yeah, more promising. Yeah, than the future of the father, which is still he is still playing in the streets of Paris. But sometimes the son joins the father playing with a street orchestra. And in this scene, when I met them and I talked with the son, he was comparing classical music to some modern music. And this is something I wanted to have again in my film. So I have to use all my capacities of invention, how I would do it, to create what you will see at the end. But probably it's better to explain what I have done after we saw the clip. That's not good.
Can you stop that clip, please? And Hedy will give you another marker.
Yeah, I asked to show it from the beginning because it has a... well, it begins with the father alone, playing cello alone. And
so you have to go back. It's about a minute or...
Because there's an amount of things I had to do to get to the point where I wanted to get. I don't know if somebody in the cabin is listening to me. Maybe I can help. I can help. Father is sitting alone and playing the cello, and then he calls his son as well, the shot.
You just need to back it up. Okay, that'll be about a minute. Thank you.
Anyway, this whole thing is about how to recreate things you have seen or heard somewhere and to give them another shape. And for many documentary makers and cinema critics, which are idiot and imbecile, that's something you shouldn't never do with a documentary because you are manipulating. This crazy old-fashioned discussion about manipulation, what you should do or not, if you could ask somebody to come inside a door for a second time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We can talk about it, but it's okay.
Eli, hai odată? Eli, vino!
Désolé, je suis en train de travailler là. Je
suis... Ouais, j'oublie. Allez. Ouais. Lâche ta guitare, toi.
C'est pas gentil. Ça va, mais parle en français là. Attends.
Oui, mais c'est pas gentil. Hein.
C'est là, pas gentil. C'est pas gentil, c'est... Ouais, c'est
les gens attendent. On a promis qu'on joue quelque chose.
Putain, tu vas pas me prendre la tête. On va leur jouer. Et puis, mais c'est tout. N'est-ce pas? On va vous jouer. Bon.
C'est au plaisir. Bon. On va jouer pour vous une pièce que j'adore parce que c'est très joyeux. C'est... Je pense qu'elle fait plaisir aux gens. Ben, on essaye. Parfois, on joue très rarement. On joue très rarement ensemble.
Bon, c'est un reproche, ça.
Oui. Bon, c'est un duo de Tommaso Giordano.
Ouais, c'est le duetto numéro uno.
Ah oui, c'est pas...
Malegro.
Ok. On y va. Thank you. Tu veux finir vite.
Ah,
c'est l'âge. Hein.
Ah, moi, je voudrais pouvoir faire ça avec mon fils. Hein.
Bah, pourquoi? Qu'est-ce qui vous empêche? Qu'est-ce qui vous en empêche?
Moi, je joue bien.
Ah, j'avais pas pensé là.
Mais toi, si tu pourrais choisir, qu'est-ce que tu jouerais?
Bah, peut-être Beethoven, du Schubert, quoi, je sais pas.
Beethoven?
Ouais. Je joue
pas Beethoven.
Je sais pas, mais Beethoven, bon, c'est Beethoven, quoi. C'est le Jimi Hendrix du classique, quoi, je sais pas. Puis, comme Schubert, c'est le Jim Morrison du classique, quoi, je sais pas. Bah, Wagner, c'est le Motorhead du classique, quoi, je sais pas. C'est
quoi,
Bach, ça,
quoi? Bach, c'est quoi? Les Rolling Stones.
Bach, c'est l'ACDC. ACDC. C'est pour moi, ça, je sais pas, c'est tous... Je sais pas, c'est...
Je connais pas ici
d'ici.
Non. Toi, tu connais, Georges?
Et si, c'est. Ta-na-na.
Je pense que c'est une. C'est un médicament. Hein. C'est une drogue, hein? Non,
c'est pas une drogue, ouais. C'est du rock'n'roll, attends. C'est...
And we'll run your clip now. And which episode are you going to show us?
It's a clip from episode 3. Flying Confessions of a Free Woman is sort of my intense journey to figure out what it means to be a woman for myself and today. And I filmed myself, my girlfriends, the women I met around the world, and the women in my family. And what I was struggling with at the very beginning was the issue of I was trying to capture the way women speak when men aren't around, these kind of endless circular conversations that women have all the time. Everybody's laughing, because we know it, right? And I'm very interested in presence, and everybody here is working with how to get people to be real in front of the camera. And I was afraid if I brought in a camera person or even put the camera on a tripod that the conversation would be destroyed and the intimacy would go and we would start acting. So I developed this very minor technique where we pass the camera during the conversation. And so what you're going to see is a passing the camera scene between myself and a woman that I've just met in India called Paramita. And Paramita is a civil rights activist in a small village called Nagpur in middle southern India. But what happens when you pass the camera is that the tables turn. And I was in a little bit of a crisis, and I was telling her, I just got a text in the film, and in that time of my life, I had two partners. I had a boyfriend, and I had a married lover. And it's true. And I just gotten a text from my married lover, and I read it to her, and that's the beginning of this scene.
Hey, you, where are you? You're like a mysterious, beautiful whale that disappears in the dark ocean. Then you occasionally surface to send a few words. You should breathe more often. But he writes like that, and I...
And you think he's a great guy. Writing words, beautiful words, has nothing to do with him because being a great guy. That's attraction. That's not love.
What's the difference?
Love is beyond attraction. It has an element of commitment. If you're attracted to a person, you can go to bed with him for a couple of nights. But that's not love. You're not committing anything either ways. Mm. And that attraction can be still true, that you really are attracted to somebody. I'm not think it's a lower level than love or anything like that. It can end up in love or it may not. But love is something that you have to work on it. It needs work.
This word work, like how?
Because if nobody's perfect. Mm. You're not perfect, your partner's situation is not perfect. But then you say that this is what I want. I want to keep this relationship. Mm. In spite of, or despite of, or because of. Mm. Sometimes you love the other people's flaws or faults or whatever, but at any rate, you're not letting go. It's really the other things that matter.
Like what?
Like, suppose you were paralyzed, would he be with you? If not, then he's not the right guy.
See, Patrick would.
Then that's the right guy.
Maybe my natural attraction is with the wrong guy. You know what I'm saying? Because then that's why I feel like I have to really rewire myself, because the people I'm attracted to aren't the people who are good for me. But maybe yes. I only know about attraction.
Yes, and you call it love. You poor American.
I don't think I'm indicative of American. I'm just my messed up self. Trying to figure out life. Patrick, all my friends really like him and my mother likes him. Very strange.
Not strange. She has a good head screwed on her shoulders very firmly. She knows a good son-in-law when she sees one.
Thanks. Thank you all for organizing that for us. I want to start with, I think what I'd like to do, and what I first want to know is, I want to know, originally I thought that this was an industry event, and I didn't realize it would be attended by public as well, so I just sort of want to get a sense. You're going to have to, this is audience participation part, so you have to put up your hands. I want to see who's a filmmaker, producer, who's sort of in the industry world of doc, oh my, okay. So there are a lot of you here. And then now public, just, you know, generic folk. Okay, well, it's almost...
oh, you.
It's almost split. So we've got makers and watchers here, which I think, you know, is interesting, and it's going to sort of form the way in which we conduct this interview here. So I wanted to start then with, let's start with the sort of the larger question of what you actually each think makes for a good interview. You're obviously influenced by different filmmakers. And within different veins of filmmaking. And I sort of, it came to me as I was watching the different styles that you each approach this with, that you all capture incredible interviews. But let's talk more specifically about, for you, you know, where that comes from, what kind of genre you're working in, and let's pull the curtain back a little bit. So maybe, Judith, you started to tell us a little bit. This is actually what's interesting about this clip that you chose in Blue Vinyl. Okay, you're looking confused, so I'll help you
everything's
out.
Everything's cool.
Sorry, everything's cool. I'll get it right. It's too many films.
I was looking confused because I'm like, which movies have I been so influenced by? And I
well,
don't really
I mean, you worked with George Stoney, for instance. I mean, you come from a very particular school of filmmaking. But I'll be more specific.
Okay.
For instance, in Everything's Cool, actually, this is the most we hear you. A lot of the time, we hear sort of little questions from you and a little bit of prodding. But this is the most engaged you are towards the end of the film. So let's talk about sort of your process within Everything's Cool here with Daniel specifically about how you come to insert yourself more so at this particular point.
Well, we co-directed this, and sometimes we were together and sometimes we weren't. Sometimes he was shooting and directing. He was always directing from behind the camera. I mean, sometimes we had other cameras, for the most part, he was always directing from behind the camera. So he was doing really two jobs and producing, so that's three. So many times I was there and sometimes I wasn't. And then there were other times when I was directing and with another cinematographer and he wasn't there. And this was one of those moments when we were having to cover sort of, I think, a number of our different characters all at the same time. And I said, well, I'll go to Boston and I'll be with Ross. And it was a week when there was going to be a series of interviews of Ross on the nightly news all across the country every single night. So I wanted to be there the night that, you know, he goes on to say, I used to be Paul Revere without a horse, now I have a horse. It's going to do anything? So so I was there by myself. And so I was watching him, you know, have this conversation about the end of the world. And I know from an earlier clip, which we could show if we have the time and it helps, where Daniel and I are both there. Daniel's shooting and I'm there, and it's another interview with the same guy. It's a very different kind of style. He's by himself, and I couldn't let him just say that, knowing that his daughter was sitting there, knowing that, right? So it wasn't a question of why am I more. We would ask questions. This was different than Blue Vinyl, which was a very interventionist piece where I was very much a character and I was, you know, inserting myself all the way along. But, you know, I think that when you really believe in something and you're really present, it ceases to be an interview. It just becomes this really wonderful exchange, and it's about reciprocity, and if you've been with your character long enough over time, then you know when they're saying something. You know, if there's enough going on in the room, then you have a sense. Like, Ross, you're talking about the end of the world, and your daughter's there, and I know that you told me earlier in the movie that you never do that, that you don't talk about this, you don't let them know, you know, how bereft you are, because you can't tell them why bother. That's an earlier clip. Yeah. So that's why I sort of caught him and I did that. So, but on the flip side, I always tell my students, I teach at NYU and I do a lot of mentoring. And I mean, a rule for me always is if you do ask a question and you're having that conversation, wait 30 seconds, 40 seconds after they answer. I mean, sort of give them a lot of time, because usually they'll say something again. They'll listen to themselves answer. You know, and the worst interviews are when you're waiting for your next question and you're really not listening. And then they don't get to listen to themselves. So if you leave with anything, it's like, brace yourself to wait for the pause, even if it's uncomfortable. And I think the magic and the serendipity and the reciprocity happens in the space between the answer and the question.
Well, then let's carry on from reciprocity, because I think what's interesting in relation to John's film is we had a little short conversation about this last night, because I was clever enough to at least pre-interview one of my subjects today. And what John had told me was that he had spent a few days, if I'm not mistaken, with his principal subject, the man that you saw in the clip, and they just talked. They talked for several days, no camera, no pen, no paper, and just got to know each other. So let's talk about how that then affects your interview and how you felt that work in relation to your subject.
Yeah, well, I very strongly, as you've indicated, believe in pre-interviewing people and in precisely those circumstances. I find that it builds confidence on the part of the film subject. I find that it builds confidence on the part of the film subject. They feel that they can relate and talk to me easily. But I'm quite different in that I do not, when I bring my cameras out, I do not want to have any of my questions heard. Suicide tourists, you'll never hear a question until almost there's one question of mine that we just couldn't avoid using because we needed it to make sense of the answer. But I believe very strongly in, of trying to do an interview in such a way that we can eliminate my questions, my presence entirely, because my own style is that I want the communication to be as direct as possible between the film subject and the audience. And I don't want to factor in to that at all. And I don't want to be seen nor heard.
And then, Hedy, in the clip that you showed us, you started to mention a little bit about recreation. So let's move into this question of, you know, first we have this idea of, you know, there's pre-interview and sometimes there's serendipity and reciprocity, and then sometimes we get to a situation in which we know something has happened and we would like to perhaps see it again. And there's always this question of, you know, what's documentary, what's not, what's real, what's not. And as you say, perhaps it's best to throw it out and not even have this question, but let's talk about what specifically happened in this clip that you showed us.
Yes. On the contrary, I am I'm always in my films present off screen. As a friend of all these characters I'm filming. What happened here is that I created the atmosphere and the way of shooting when I was in the apartment. When I was visiting one time, there was a lot of noise of this guitar in the room of the kids, and I felt that the father was annoyed. He was annoyed by many reasons, not only because there was noise and he wanted to talk with us, but because this is another world. He comes from Romania, and probably his son would have never heard about AC/DC if he will have remained in Romania. My idea was, so I want to come to this moment where I was in this cafe bar in Paris, and the guy began to talk about relationships between classical music and other musics. And of course, I wanted to show a very tender moment between father and son, and the differences in generation. Because the son has really grown up almost in Paris. But I had a slight idea how I could get to this guy talking about classical music and modern music. And what I did is, there is one cut in the scene, so when you go from the room and you go back to the when they are sitting, I have a cut, and you see them from the front to play. So there's a moment where the camera has to move. You have to change the angriness. From father and son are gone, because you have to change
the tone. You mean they go from one emotion to another?
Yeah. So before beginning to shoot, I was saying to Eliad, the son, you were really boring when you came into the room. You were attacking your father, and we lose so many time with you. So what are you complaining? He got another time angry, as he was when he came in the other shot. that's what I did, and then shooting. But, and they were quarreling, and I really no idea how, what I will do to, and in those moments, I prohibit myself to think anymore, and I say, well, it will come or will not come. It will happen or not happen. And it makes no sense to continue thinking how you will come to the point that you want it. So they begin to play and play, and I was very emotional. I felt this father and son playing, and really I was thinking about my son, Stefan, that I would like very much to have this kind of moments with him. And I say, about stupid Hedy, that's what you have to say. Just react as you are feeling. And they finished, and blah, blah, blah. They were quarreling a little bit. You did it too quickly. You are, that's the youth. You are, you don't have time. And then I said this to the boy. So I would like very much that I could do this with my son. I just said what I felt. And then the whole thing moved like smoothly to this 1.5 year ago in this cafe. And of course, the comparisons were different than at those days. But he did the same, and it was a lot of fun because I really didn't know AC/DC and. And he was so astonished. For me, it was another world. And for the father, he didn't know either, and it was a drug. So I think that maybe because, but so some other people could do it without having done fiction. I've done fiction before doing documentary, and it's, I'm never afraid to meet a character before shooting, some months before or half a year, because, and even talk for days with this person, because of the moment that you will begin to film, you will react in a different way, and you will of course be aware that you have, that maybe could be that a person remembers what you are looking for. And I have to make my best so that the person forgets it. So it's a very common example. If the guy is waiting me to ask him, well, when you departed from Romania and you came to Paris, I will never ask this. He's probably waiting that I will start like that. I will start saying, "So, oh, you have not so many music books here. What happened? What's happening?" And then he will forget the whole situation and the camera and everything, and be himself. And that's what happens in this scene. There were even with a change of, it's not two cameras. In France, they thought I was shooting with two cameras. No, you have a lapse and changing, but you have to recreate a situation, the tone where you were, mm-hmm. There you have to bring it and then go and fly. Yeah. So from something you know, you pass to something you don't know what will happen, and then the click comes. So anyway.
And we're gonna fly right over here. Now, in terms of, you started this film quite differently from what I understand. It wasn't meant to be episodic, correct? And it became that for commercial reasons and in order to create something because you just couldn't make a feature. Is that what I understand?
No, it's definitely not at all for commercial reasons. It's easier to make a feature than a six-hour film. I strongly advise don't go out and try to make a six-hour film. So.
But you're good at it,
yeah.
So you keep doing it.
No, it was simply that the premise of the flying was to capture these different levels of stories and to see if there was a connection between my life, my friend's life, my mother's life, and the women I met around the world. And that premise was too big in narrative terms for a feature. And because I did it over 5 years, it was recording our lives over time. And I was very interested in story. And I was not making a talking head film. I was making a film about lives changing in real story. But I just want to say I agree with my wonderful friends here on everything. And that for me, the way I approach a film is totally subject to the film story. And there have been films in which I do what we would consider quite classic interviewing, where I would never, ever talk about my personal life. And then to this extreme where I use myself and expose myself both for the premise of the film, which is to figure out who the hell I am as a woman, and also as a catalyst to encourage other women to talk openly. My main goal in whatever technique I'm using, I think is probably similar to all of us, which is to get to a real moment on film. And in this word interview, for me it's about creating a sacred space in which the subject can, in a sense, go on a journey in the moment and say something that they may not have ever said before, and also which I am not anticipating. So we both are in unknown ground. Now, the problem is, of course, that sometimes it takes 2 hours to get to that moment of magic, and sometimes there's a lot of beginning in that. There's a lot of how do you feel today, what's going on. There's a lot of interchange before that moment occurs. In flying, I did something I've never done before and I thought I would never do, which is I didn't pre-interview anybody, let alone myself. I met people with the camera rolling. And the technique was to say, here's the camera, this is just a silly little thing that is part of our conversation. So the minute I met people, whether it was an old friend or my mother, or in this case, India, I got off the plane filming, the camera was part of our relationship, and very quickly I would pass it. Here's the camera, how do you use it? Well, it's all automatic, it doesn't matter. Just, the only thing you have to know is you have to point it at me when I'm talking, and I will point it at you when you're talking, because there was no sound person. So I put the camera in the center of the relationship on purpose. Now, I have worked very differently, and it works beautifully also, where I establish rapport and relationship and pre-interview without a camera. I would say, I assume that for me, there are no rules. There are only things that work best in the circumstance of the story you're trying to tell.
I think what's interesting is that we have very different examples of interview technique here. And for you, in this particular film, it created what you felt to be greater intimacy. But what I see in each film, which is very clear to me, is that the intimacy, which is what makes you all master filmmakers, is felt in each one of these films. So what I'd like to do is maybe shift it a little bit to the nuts and bolts of, you know, we can talk in very general terms about that, but I think it's important to talk in more specific terms, too, about how you get to those places, specifically in terms of, first of all, I think in terms of Hedy, for instance, I'm interested to know a little bit more about how you, it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that you construct your films very carefully in advance. For instance, in Crazy, In Crazy, there's a section in which Crazy is a film about that's showing here at the festival also, that is about soldiers, Dutch peacekeepers who have experienced post-traumatic stress disorder from the various places in which they've served, including Bosnia and they've been to
Rwanda,
Cambodia, Korea. And in it, you ask them each to respond to a piece of music. That you ask them to say, what is the piece of music that has had great significance for you? But you don't never hear this question, right? You don't feel any of this. Just like in John's film, you don't feel so much the hand of the filmmaker in this instance. So how is it when you set this up? Do you set this up in advance? Is this a conversation that you have with them before? And you tell them this, and then you go ahead and film afterwards. Are they listening to the music, or is it something you put in after the fact?
No, of course they are listening at that moment to the music. Some of the moments in my films are, I wouldn't call them constructed, but guided, pre-researched. For instance, in The Soldiers in Crazy, I had long conversations with most of them, and I knew which piece of, because in fact Crazy is not about the soldiers of the UN. I always say Crazy is about the power music has in the most horrible situation where a person can be. That's a war. And those pieces of music were saving. They were saving these soldiers from solitude and from getting crazy. The moments where I decided, so there was these conversations, because that's how I call them, not interviews but conversations. I never have interviews with people. I had these conversations with them, and sometimes I had the feeling now it's the moment to put the music. The music was recorded live, and they were listening live, and there was an agreement between me and them, because it was a difficult moment. This music was, as John Anderson wrote about Crazy some time ago, is in without words, you see in the faces the horror which the war has left in them. So it was the frontier between being a filmmaker and a voyeur, and I had to be very careful not to trespass this frontier. So there was this agreement, I will film you like naked. You are naked because you are giving me everything. You are listening to this music, and it will be painful. You will have a lot of memories, but you understand that this is good for the film. And I understand I have my frontiers. So there is a kind of agreement between you and the character you are filming. And this agreement makes that you can keep on the side of being a filmmaker and not a voyeur. And the moment where I started with the music, sometimes it was at the end of all the conversation, but sometimes in the middle of it, I think I have to make a cut, and probably we will continue in the afternoon with the conversation. Now it's the moment of the music. So the whole preparation to, that's my soundman, who is the best soundman of all the Netherlands. He had a whole construction, how to put the music and record it directly in his recorder while they were listening. And sometimes you hear them breathing or saying things or singing with music. It's very powerful. And, well, that's it?
That's pretty good. John, speaking of, you know, powerful moments at the end of films, you have this interview section towards the very end where you're actually seeing your subject die. It's not the end, but you actually are filming him in the process of death. Can you talk a little bit about sort of how you went through the process of negotiating that beforehand and then what that was like to actually be there with your cameraman? And it's actually the first time I noticed that there was sort of a lot of movement with your cameraman. And I sensed anxiety, but maybe you could tell us a little bit about what happened and how you got to that place where you felt it was okay to do that.
Well, excuse me. Well, I spent, as I say, 3 days with Craig Ewart prior to filming, and he and I basically swapped life stories during that time. He was just as interested in me as I was in him. And at the end of that process, there developed a trust between the two of us, so that he and his wife, Mary, decided that he would indeed let me film the entire process. And right from the outset, we made it very clear between ourselves that at any point, if he wanted the cameras to stop, I would stop. And that all he had to do was indicate that he didn't want to go any further, and we would stop. And on that was the basis of the trust that existed between us. The trust also naturally consisted of the fact that he knew I shared the same politics as he did, and that we were both, as it were, on the same side of the cause. And I had witnessed a suicide a year earlier and the process that was involved in it. So I had a whole year to think about this and to plan for when the moment came. And I knew that it would take Craig 45 minutes to die, and that therefore we could and did move the camera. It was, for all of us who were present that day, my cameraman, my sound man, my producer, and myself, you know, probably the most disturbing and challenging day of our careers collectively. And we just basically tried to stay as professional and concentrate on what we were doing at the time we were doing it. And none of us showed or any of the emotions we were experiencing until we were finished and we were back in the hotel.
Thank you. I want to ask Judith a question as well, but I want to take a breath on that one. because while you can remain professional, I found it extremely overwhelming and to watch that. But it was also the point at which I found I broke down was actually your interviewing of his wife just after the fact. And that was really, and those are one of those moments that just sort of happened. But I also want to open it up to you guys a little bit. So Judith, if you'll forgive me, I'm sure they have questions for you as well. So I think I'd like to turn it over to you guys for some questions. And there is a microphone that's circulating around. So just put your hand up. So do we have a first question? Back here.
Can you all talk a little bit about the sound people that you work with and what kind of preparation you like to do with them, or some of the different experiences that you've had working with good and bad sound persons?
Do you want me to take that? We've worked with a lot of sound people. One of the best that we've worked with is a wonderful man named Gabriel Miller, who now lives in Seattle. He used to live in New York. And I always say, when he moved to Seattle, he said, listen, no one really knows me here. Can you give me a blurb? And I said, Gabriel doesn't listen with his ears, he listens with his heart. And he does. And I think that the best sound people
are so proficient with their craft and they know their equipment so well. You know, some people like this, they sleep with their equipment, they make love to their equipment, they have the most intimate relationship with that equipment. We should be jealous of that equipment, you know? And so it's that's not their, they know when it doesn't work, they know how to fix it, they have the goods with them, they know how to do it well, they know how to jerry-rig it, they're not afraid to do that, but at the same time, it's like, that's not what they know to trust that, so what they're really listening to is what's going on. At the same time, you know, they have such high standards that we find that we have to create a standard with each other. So, you know, he might say, I'm sorry, there's airplane, and it's an, you know, we have to trust that we know how to talk to each other. It's like, I know there's an airplane, but there's an extraordinary thing going on, and so the airplane is now part of the story. I don't care. We'll use it. Or we'll ask the question again later, and then he'll whisper to me and say, you know what, there was an airplane. I didn't want to say anything because I knew there was an extraordinary thing going on, but you might want to ask that question again later, find another way, or just, you know, let's listen for that to happen again. So if in the event that it wasn't what you wanted with the airplane, you'll have that and you can cover. So, you know, there's just, I think you have to establish this relationship. You have to establish an agreement on what acceptable means and what good means. And if they understand the story and they're with you and you always talk with them about story and never, I mean, I never think about them as just, you know, a technician, but if they're there with the story, then they really, it just works so much better. Is that a good enough answer?
We have another question back here.
This question is for Jennifer. I was just blown away by the intimacy of.
Can you talk a little closer to the mic?
Is that better? I was just blown away by the intimacy of the clip you showed us, and I just wanted to know. And you also said that you didn't do any pre-interviews or anything, and I'm very new to this, and I've been interviewing for the last year, and I find the scariest moment is when you turn the camera on and you start asking a question, and I'm wondering, how do you start?
There are different answers, but flying again was this weird situation where I was flying around the world and meeting people that I didn't know. And again, I've never done this before as a filmmaker. So I got off the airplane in India. I had met Paramita for 20 minutes in New York before, but other characters in the film I hadn't even met. So in this case, because I knew that this was the structure of this film, I made rules for myself. And one of the rules, I made a lot of rules. One was filming from the minute, you know, from the very beginning. So turning on and off that fear factor was totally diminished because I was running all the time. The other thing was, it was a rule that I had to live in the character's home. I didn't stay in hotels, and most of the time it meant on the floor. And the reason why Paramita was and I were so close so quickly is I was sleeping in her bedroom on the floor. And immediately, you know, when you're like 17, hitchhiked around somewhere, Europe or Canada or whatever, you know that when you're alone, and I was shooting solo, so no sound person, nobody, myself and my little camera, you know that when you're alone, you are really depending on the kindness of strangers, and the other people really take that on themselves. So I think that worked for the filming, and the story is that she took care of me, and therefore that created a kind of intimacy. However, in today, if I take a different kind of filming, the project I made before this was a 10-hour series about an interracial family in America, and I was not in the film. The film was not about me. Maybe you heard my voice twice in 10 hours. In that situation, I set up very classic interviews where, you know, you're setting up the camera and there is a moment where the interview begins. And at that point, what I do, instead of going to my questions, I always try to start where the person is. Like, maybe they're involved, you know, maybe they just got off the phone with their child, or they were watching the news. So I literally say to them, because usually they're spacing out a bit while you're setting up, what are you thinking about? What's on your mind? And I enter the conversation where they are, and eventually work into what I want to talk about. But what I want to talk about, it becomes sort of natural. And because, again, the questions sometimes are secondary to bringing them into the room. I want them to be there with me. I don't want them to be telling me what they've already told 20 million times before. So the first thing is that establishing of rapport and presence.
Thank you.
Okay. I'll take something on this side of the room over here.
My question also goes to Jennifer Fox, and the thing is, I would like to know much more about the way you were working with passing the camera on and off. And I was really wondering, I mean, is there a natural conversation possible when you have to pause during you pass the camera over? Isn't there the problem that the subjects, when they film you, they are distracted by watching the camera? Is it a new invention? And finally, were there moments when this technique didn't work, and why did it not work then?
I won't answer all of it, but I was working with an extremely small camera. It's a PDX-10, PD-100. It's about that big. I wouldn't work with anything bigger because it is too heavy for an ordinary person. Us filmmakers are very built, like muscular and all that, but when I pitched this idea, the commissioning editors all said it wouldn't work because lay people can't film. And what you learn immediately is that everybody can film, because even you go to Pakistan or you go to Cambodia, people are so television savvy. They are so born and bred on television that they know how to frame an image. And usually it takes about 3 minutes to give them a lesson. You know, it's, again, because the mic is on the camera, because they point the camera at the person talking. And I'm using a flip screen, so I ask them to look at me. So set your frame and look up, because it is dependent on eye contact. What happens, weirdly, and I found this out when I was developing the idea, is when you pass, instead of people getting distracted, they get excited. And this idea of presence actually happens, and they show up. Because the minute the camera is brought into the scene, they're like, wow. And then when they get to ask you a question, it is so exciting for them not to be on the spot, to have that power, that the energy of the room raises 100%. And then, in this case, one of the rules for me was that I was committed to total honesty, meaning I was using, to the best of my ability, I would be totally honest at all times. So if somebody asked me about how many men did you sleep with, which happened a few times in your life, I was really there trying to be real, because it also was a real journey for me. So my honesty then, when I asked them a question and said, okay, provoked their honesty. And a little bit like Hetty was saying, we didn't pass on the word, because we had put a little mic in the back, a little lavalier. So I could be asking them a question, or they could ask me a question, and I would start talking while I was still holding the camera. So it was more like a dance that was very natural and was not methodical. You know, there are some answers that are off camera and some that are on camera. And it actually was more like what they talk about in sort of traditional Indian terms of a talking stick. The camera became a modern talking stick and actually got people much more present and much more open very quickly.
I think, Hedy, you wanted to respond a little bit to this as well.
No, to respond. Just to to speak in a place, to speak in place representing the camera society who is not here. That it's not true what you're saying, that everybody can film. I don't believe in this. It's one of the most difficult things for a director is where you have to put your camera. And we are teaching in your film it works because it's just it's a shot of a face. So, but
I have to say this is a case of don't try this at home, kids.
To make a shot like the one we saw at the film of Judith, the three of them, it's you have to think about it really. How to do it. It's one of the most. I like very much.
In certain instances, it works. But
I would like to just say I totally agree with Hedy. Of course, this is totally circumstance related to the intimate conversation between women. You can pass with men too. I would say try it at home. It works. But it isn't the same as another part of filmmaking, which is, of course, creating a scene, filming a scene, where to put your camera. And as Hedy said, and I've learned, I've often tried to replace myself as a camera person. And honestly, not everybody knows how to shoot a scene. So I am a camera person because I think I know how to shoot a scene. So I was only talking in terms of this little intimate conversation, and her point is well taken.
You know, I did the similar thing when I made this film called A Healthy Baby Girl, which was on in Canada, I think in 1998, but a long time ago. But it was an autobiographical film about me and my mother and my experience with cancer caused by a drug called DES, which my mom had taken. And it was primarily about our relationship over 5 years and the impact of chemical exposure on the most sacred relationship in your life and how it can insinuate itself into a relationship and how a chemical can do that. So the role of the camera was, in that scenario, I really was trying to use it to save our relationship, at least I thought I was, and to sort of be witness to sort of what could potentially happen, the big implosion that I was afraid of. But over time, you know, I was handing my mother the camera, and it was just, because it was about our relationship, and somehow it was like, I think my mother felt, it was liberating for my mom to learn how to use the camera, because then, you know, I could talk directly to her, and the camera wouldn't be in her mind, the camera wasn't between us anymore because it was in her hand. She actually got quite good at it, but it didn't really matter. I mean, I didn't mind the fact that whenever we included, you know, the moving and the sounds that came from moving, and ultimately by the end of the film, she was really good, and she took some beautiful shots, and we filmed her filming, but it was all built into the relationship, and the learning how to use the camera and the role of the camera was built into the storytelling. So it wasn't even about the cinema of it. It was about the relationship and the stakes of the relationship. And I think that's when it really works. I mean, you have to feel palpable stakes about something. And I think all of these characters have some palpable stakes. And that's really what's at the heart of, if you call it an interview or a conversation or a film or a story, you know, it's like, should he, you know, he has stakes in his decision, you know? And, you know, you guys have created stakes. So I think that's... So that in that scenario, the camera represented the stakes.
I want to get a couple more questions in because I know we're running thin on time. So over here in the blue, we have a lot of questions. So please make them brief, and we'll try it. Go ahead here. There's somebody right over here.
Hi, This is a question for Hedy, but anyone else jump in if you feel so inclined. I wanted to ask you, Hedy, about your when you do like pre-production and you're doing like storyboarding and figuring out, okay, this is how this film is going to go, and then you do your interviews, and then you get into post where finally the story really comes together. How far off is it from what you originally intended? Do the interviews really change the nature of what it is that you started off with?
Sorry, could you repeat?
Okay, so in my understanding, in terms of filmmaking, there's three places where the film gets made. Originally, when you're storyboarding in the beginning, and then when you interview in production, and then in post, when you go to cut and edit. So how far off are you from the original storyboard that you started off with all the way to the cutting, you know, when you're in edit? I mean, do the interviews really take you to a new place?
There are many questions in one.
I think the general gist of her question is, how much does it change for you from the beginning of your story to the place when you're finished editing, from when you have the idea for it to when you're finished?
Sometimes it can change totally. And sometimes it can have a blueprint of the old conversation months ago, because you are in a different situation and the person also, and you have a lot of experience. There is a camera and everything is different. Something much more extraordinary happens. Of course, if something which is less extraordinary happens, you will never see it because I will cut it away in editing. So you always are trying to surpass everything you know about your script, your idea, and that's when you let it be, when an enormous injection of life comes into everything. The camera. Yesterday I was explaining how long you can discuss with your camera where to put it, and which is extremely, it's a great craft, and something people should be taught more in film school, because it can change your whole approach to a person or a scene. Where you put your camera and what lens you're using, so between a storyboard which I never make, I have just a slight knowledge about how, and then when I'm surplus, I take the decisions together with a camera or alone, or where we fight fight about it. Or we celebrate that we find the big thing, the place, the method to do it. So that's the flow. Mm-hmm. The flow till you edit it is a long way where things change, move, and all the flow, it's about that for first that you believe that what's happening on your editing is the best thing you can do. Okay. And when you believe that, then that's your final point. Then you can discuss with commissioning editors who come into the editing room and say, well, I think you should cut the scene there. And then you can say, no, I don't think so, because then this person is saying this and this, and then you see the window and there is the air coming and you see the neighborhood. So no, I cannot finish that. No, mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. And they haven't seen nothing of that. So you can surprise them, because they were just looking to something they wanted to look and not right. to the real thing.
Right. I think we have to unfortunately end it there, but I think we were 5 minutes late. I know Hot Docs is going to kill me, but we were 5 minutes late, so take one more, and I'm going to be a rebel, and that's just the way I am. So take one more, and but please keep your answers short.
Mr. Zariski, you have said that you are extremely professional and seemingly exceptionally stoic in your filmmaking procedure, in comparison with three more visceral and emotional filmmakers. Are there any times when, in the past or in the future, you could see changing or, yeah, changing your way of making a film?
Well, I'm glad you gave me a chance to sort of correct maybe a misapprehension that I may have given everybody here. It's not that I'm not affected by films that I make and situations I find myself in, but I liken myself much to an airline pilot or a surgeon, and at the time, I'm focusing and concentrating on what I have to do professionally. I mean, I've now seen Craig Ewart die 30 times altogether, and every time I see him die in the editing room, it disturbs me deeply. Every time I see Suicide Tourist, it breaks me down at some point during the film. Different points, but at some point. So, I mean, it does affect me. But I, as I say, I try to keep my cool. Because if I don't keep my cool in those circumstances, everybody else will lose theirs and will have a terrible, chaotic situation that isn't good for anybody, either personally or professionally.
So you're a compassionate professional.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, but it's with
how did I know this was going to happen with three directors here? Four directors, excuse me.
It's about giving space to the subject to have their experience. That's why he keeps his cool, not because he's cold.
I want to thank all our panelists and you too, and take note. Make sure you see all their films. Thank you.
Professional, and that concept undermines, I don't think it's the right word for what you do, right? I mean, I